All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksters, what's happening? It's Mark Maron. This is my podcast. This is my voice coming to you from the new garage. It's an empty garage. It might have a slight effect on the sound, but we're going to chip away at it. I got to get the books on the shelves. I got to get the foam up. I got to get some life into this place, but I'm here. I'm here. I'm tucked away in a corner of my new space, and it's spectacular. It looks spectacular. It feels good. It's a little weird, though, folks. It's a little weird. I'm not going to lie to you. I've been going through somewhat of a crisis. I mean, after I got all that stuff out of the old garage, I mean, I was in there, and I know this has been going on for a while, but I was in that garage for a long time. I was in there for years. It was like, it was a part of my body. It was, we had a symbiotic relationship. We were one. Me and that old garage were one. And I got to tell you, when I emptied it out entirely, and it was just hollow, and it was just that linoleum floor that I had put in there with some, you know, big idea after I pulled the rug up, it was just those tiles there and nothing else in it. It was rough. And then I left and I laid in bed and I was like, oh man, I felt like I had lost my Siamese twin. I felt like it was removed, but that's not even a good analogy. I just felt like I was kind of a part of me was broken away, and to detach from it was crazy. But here I am, I'm in the new space, and it's roomy, it's beautiful. There's a bathroom right over there. There's some windows. And I just got to get the foam up. I got to get the books out. I got to get stuff going. But it's probably ongoing. I'm probably going to experience some grief. And I don't know how it's going to manifest itself. But I woke up in somewhat of a panic. Before I get too far into this, I wanted to give a shout out to my buddy Joe Matarese. He was on this show about a year ago, and now he's got his own podcast. It's called Stand Up, Lie Down, and he hosts it with his friend Dr. Keith. They're basically taking the whole stand up as therapy thing to its logical conclusion. On each episode, they talk to a different comic and use their stand up act to get to the bottom of their issues. You can get it on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you listen to podcasts. It's weird to start here at the ground level again, to be sitting in a room with boxes all over the floor and just stuff around that needs to be sorted out and put in its proper place. It feels like the beginning of the podcast when I was just sitting in the middle of that old garage and it was just basically a place to put shit. But I'm back now. I'm back in that. But obviously, it's a little different. I've made a choice. I've moved to a place that's more comfortable and interesting to me. And I've got a new garage, and this is where we're at. Did I mention today is Neil Patrick Harris Day on the show? These are a series of interviews still that were recorded in the old space. Oh man, don't freak out, I said to myself. Don't freak out, I said to me. It's going to be okay, folks. It's going to be exciting. Right now, this was exciting, actually. Michael Imperioli reached out to me. He wrote a novel, and I don't always, you know, read everything that I'm supposed to read to do these interviews because I don't think it's relevant. But Imperioli and I had a beautiful chat years ago, and he wrote this novel and he wanted to talk about it. So I thought I owed it to him, and it's the right thing to do. And out of respect for the work he did, I read the novel. It's called The Perfume Burned His Eyes. It's out now. You can get it wherever you get books. And it's a beautiful little coming of age story. It's sort of a slightly dark coming of age story that he really put his heart into. And it was a great read. I enjoyed it. I really did. And it was great for Michael to come by and talk about it. I guess he's also got a new ABC show, Alex Inc. But Imperioli's a solid cat, and this was really, and I'm being honest here. Hear me, because I'm being honest. This was a good read, and it was a heartfelt book, and it's a sweet book, and it takes place at a time in New York that I kind of remember. But it's a little gritty, but it's still a coming of age story about a 17-year-old kid, and Lou Reed is in it. Lou Reed is a character in this coming of age story, which is spectacular. So this is me and Michael Imperioli talking about his new book, The Perfume Burned His Eyes. Yeah. So this morning, I finished your book, and I loved it. And I ended up this morning, it was not anticipated, but I ended up listening to Blue Mask and Street Hassle.
Nice. Nice.
Is it a great way to start the day? I don't know. But there's great records.
And great records.
And so this book, I love that it was that you wrote it from the point of view of a high school kid. You know, I think that the tone of it was great. It was very engaged. I found it very moving and exciting. And it brought me back to... I didn't grow up in the city, but I used to go to New York because I have family in Jersey and stuff in the 70s, and it really made me feel what it was like then again.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. It was very, it had its very specific flavor and character.
It did, didn't it? And yeah. I think you really got that pretty good.
Yeah.
Were you going into the city then? I mean.
I was in 76, I was 10, so we'd go to the city for like, to see the, you know, Statue of Liberty.
From where? Where were you?
I grew up. Like
Westchester?
Mount Vernon, on the city border of the Bronx.
Yeah.
So it's very close to the city, but yet, you know, we'd go to the baseball game, right. The circus.
Yeah, the rink, Barnum and Bailey at Madison Square Garden.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Once in a while a play.
Right.
My parents, we went to see a couple of plays.
Yeah.
But I didn't know the city at all.
You
know?
Nah?
No, it was very abstract. I was a little kid.
It's kind of weird to me, though, but a little kid and what? So this takes most of the narrative of the book. It's you writing. See, this is the thing. I had to picture you the whole way through.
It's not me, though.
I know that.
Definitely not.
Okay. But that's just what I do with people who write books.
I understand that, of course.
You're playing the kid.
I'm playing the kid in the movie.
Exactly. No, you're playing the kid in the book.
In the book, which is a movie in your head when you're
right,
reading.
Kind of. Right. But so that most of the action or most of the narrative takes place is a recollection in 1977 because...
Right.
So he's looking back at what year?
Well, most of the book is written from the point of view of a boy at 18, about to be 18,
yeah,
in a mental hospital.
Yeah.
Looking at what happened the last 2 years. It's
two years.
Journal.
Right.
And then the epilogue takes place...
Years later, 2013.
In 2013, which is 35 years later, I guess.
Well, the thing
Three days after Lou Reed's death.
Right, right. And that is sort of an in memoriam.
Right.
To Lou Reed.
Right.
So, but you didn't... when you were writing this, I don't know when you wrote it, did you anticipate that happening? Or did you write this after he died?
Well, when I started the book, I wanted to write a coming-of-age story.
Yeah.
Kind of it's something that's always been... very close to my heart.
Yeah.
From when I was a kid.
Like, which ones do you like? Catcher in the Rye?
Of course.
Right.
I mean, that's, how could you not like that? That's such a seminal
piece
of work.
Yeah.
But also Candide, which I read, which is not necessarily coming age, but in some ways it is. But I read that as a teenager. It made a huge impression on me.
Yeah.
And I hadn't looked at Candide again, maybe since I was a teenager.
Yeah.
And I just picked it up a couple of months ago, and I realized how much that book has, it may influence the writing of this, but just influenced me, I think, in general as an artist. As a way to relate to the 16-year-old mind, because my son was turning 16, and he was going through what kids go through at that age, and I just wanted to relate to that state of mind. So I started writing...
Before Lou died or after?
Before Lou died.
Oh, okay.
Started writing the character, and... There was an early version of this character in a script that I wrote of a pilot that I sold to HBO that didn't get made.
Oh, okay.
Very different, but the character was
Matt.
The core. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then...
What was it about this character? If this guy's not you, because to me, all the buttons were pushed for me reading the book because, you know, I don't know. How old are you?
52 this
month. I'm 54, right? So just a couple years older than you, but it was all very familiar to me. You know, like right. I was a little older when I was down in Alphabet City, you know?
So was I. I didn't get to the city till 1983 when I was 17.
Oh, okay. So,
it's not that far away.
No, but also, so you were at the age of this kid, really?
I was a little older. None of the events that happened to this kid ever happened to me. I mean, except from being, a teenager in this big city, you know?
And, right.
And
you moved there when you were 17?
I started going to acting school. I was kind of in and out. I'd go back home, I'd stay there, and then I finally moved permanently, I guess, like 85.
So this kid, he stifles himself a lot because he's overwhelmed all the time, you know, and he's about to get sick half the time when he has feelings,
and
right?
He's afraid of, the world's a big place to him. And I think
going from Queens to New York City, that you really sort of like, you brought that, like, because I don't think people realize that, like even in Westchester, you know, it's like, the city's there.
Right.
But it's just big menacing place. No one, you know.
Especially then.
Yeah.
It was a little more of today's world is a lot smaller in general because everybody's a lot more aware of what's going on all the time because of, you know, the way we communicate and stuff. But especially then.
Yeah.
You know, his journey from Jackson Heights to Manhattan was only a couple, maybe 2 miles or 3 miles, but it's. You know, light years apart in terms of...
Yeah, it's like people on the island who never go to the city. They never go, maybe for a concert, but barely then, hardly that.
Or when relatives come to town and you take them to the Empire State Building.
Yeah, because you live in New York.
Right.
Yeah. I underlined one sentence in the book for some reason because I liked it. When you were in the magic store.
The occult
store. Was that? It's a real store, right? There was a real store down there. I was trying to remember.
There was a couple.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was one in like the Flatiron District that was, I think, lasted longer. But the one there was one in the East Village.
Right.
I can't even remember the name, which were always very, if you had ever gone to those places, they were very strange.
Sure, sure. You know, you got all places. The amulets. Well, you describe it very well. But the sentence I underlined was air that had grown thick from years of desperate aspirations. Some fulfilled, some fruitless, most of them malicious.
Right. you could feel that in those places.
So. Yeah. Well, I think the real hook of this book, you know, for me and I think, you know, for you too, because we had talked about the last time you were here, we talked about our love of Lou Reed, is that, you know, the device in this book that is really sort of amazing is that this kid coincidentally moves into the building that Lou Reed lives in, that your character, Matthew, moves in with his mother, who leaves a life in Jackson Heights because of an inheritance and, you know, things had not gone right. Your father's dead, your grandfather's dead. But she takes up this place in the city in Midtown, and Lou Reed lives in your building.
Right.
And not yours, the character. Sorry, I always do that with writers.
He lives, well, in the 76, he did live in the east side of Manhattan in kind of a neighborhood you wouldn't really think of him living in because he was always a downtown guy for most of
in
his
76
life.
So that was because like I was trying because this is like really Lou like hitting bottom.
I don't he might have had a couple of bottoms, but he went you know, the album Street Hassle I think came from a very painful place. There was a breakup and I mean Street Hassle, which I think is the song, especially Street Hassle, is just such a brilliant piece of work. But Lou is there to serve as a certain, because this kid loses the two major male role models in his life at this very critical point in his adolescence. And
when he's, what, 17?
16. And Lou emerges as this kind of quasi-father figure, despite his own madness and not intentionally becoming a father figure.
And not really showing up as a father figure at all.
No.
Other than remembering your name finally.
Right. And that, I mean, that's on the kind of literal level, but on another level, to me, the book is about the formation of an artist.
Well, I thought the interesting thing was, knowing what you know about Lou, and I figured you did some research on it, and, you know, is that, you know, the kid didn't know who he was.
He didn't know who he was.
And that, you know, even all the way through the relationship, you know, he knew he had a thing, he had a hit, or he had a song he recognized, but that the attraction and the desire to be close to Lou was more based on just the uniqueness of his life and the intensity of his personality.
Exactly.
And I thought that was an interesting choice. So you don't have any celebrity element in there. You know, it was just this weird dude with the weird haircut who didn't look like anybody else.
And didn't look like he didn't belong in that neighborhood, in that area. But there was something that, you know, this kid, something in his aura and his energy struck a nerve with this kid. That what I, in my mind, was saying that it's about a certain artistic vision and a certain artistic consciousness that this kid is drawn to. And later in the book, in one of Lou's desperate moments, he takes this kid down to the Village, to this theater, to see this play.
Right.
And later on, we see that this kid is, when he's in the hospital, he writes a play.
Yeah, the little
he
play.
He starts
yeah.
to write a play.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
it's
a comedic
the seeds
play.
Of saying, well, this is how the Lou
oh,
is bestowing
it, right.
and
sure.
influencing the you know the artistic circle of life.
Well, I think that also what was exciting for me is that like, and I struggle with this all the time. It takes it, you know, that Lou Reed as a presence and a phenomenon, you know, everybody knows. But to really love Lou Reed all the way through everything he did is a rare person. You know what I mean? That like that whatever your sensitivity is, I have it as well. And he's as troubling as he is compelling to me.
It's even during the course of his career. And
sure,
and
you know, just even the music. Some of it's a little too vulnerable for me, and some of it's a little too stupid for me, and some of it's, you know, like, you know, some of it's affected. But, like, you know, there's always one or two that keeps pushing me through.
But, I mean, you really have to take Lou's work from the whole scope, I think.
Yeah.
Of what he, you know, and he was always challenging himself as an artist from beginning to end.
Right.
I mean, Lulu, what he did with Metallica.
Yeah, I gotta give that like, another listen. I didn't see, like, I didn't.
And Ecstasy, which was an album came out around 2000 or 1999, 2000, is a very underrated, excellent album. The song Rock Minuets on that record. But I mean, he's making this in his now early 60s.
Yeah.
So it's not a lot of artists that can maintain that. You know, Neil Young is one who just sort of
sure.
maintains that level of still trying to discover, still trying to push themselves. And, you know, there's successes and failures along the way, and there's better and worse along the way.
Sure.
But there was always that underlying.
Well, I like aesthetic. The thing he did with John Cale. What was that, in the 80s or 90s?
Songs for Drella.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, and Magic and Loss you brought up in the book.
It's amazing. New York is tremendous.
New York's great.
Tremendous, yeah. That's where the title comes from the song Romeo Had Juliet.
Oh.
He says, the perfume burned his eyes, holding tightly to her thighs. Something yeah. flickered for a minute, then it vanished and was gone.
Yeah.
It's always stuck in my head forever, and I always wanted to figure out a way to use that somehow.
Yeah.
And this originally was called Anywhere You Like.
Yeah.
Which is a line when he gets the job. He first goes in the diner, and the waiter looks like he's going to be mean, and then he says, Anywhere You Like. And to him, the kid, that phrase was like, he just got to the city, and it's like, okay, people seem like they're kind of gruff and
right,
mean,
yet yeah,
actually
like
it's just because that's the way people are in the city. But then as I kept writing, it didn't really encompass what I wanted for the, you know, because you don't know where the story's going to go when you're writing it. You know, I didn't know.
No?
No. I didn't really have I had kind of a little germ or seed. I didn't know what the story was going to be.
Did you know he was going to meet Lou Reed?
Not at the very beginning, no. That happened. Then what happened was, this is going back to where we started. Started this coming of age story, and while I was into that, Lou died.
Yeah.
And it hit me very surprisingly hard in a couple of different ways.
Yeah.
You know, and both because I knew him and I really liked him a lot. And he was
you developed
really
a kind. Relationship with him later in his life?
Yeah. It's around 2000.
Yeah.
And he was just a very generous to me and really kind and warm.
Did you spend time with him?
Yeah, we did. I met him at a show.
Yeah.
At one of his shows backstage. And he came when I screened a movie that I directed. He came. I invited him, and he came. We hosted a couple of benefits together for Jazz Foundation and for the Tibet Fund.
I
visited him in the rehearsal studio when he was revisiting Metal Machine in around 2010.
And, revisiting it?
He did. He went on tour and was playing like kind of like reworked versions of Metal Machine music live. And this is 2010 or 11. This is another thing you gotta remember about. A couple of years before he died.
Yeah, he's doing that album, which is like just an obliteration of music.
Yeah, but he was kind of reworking it to make it, I think, I didn't see that show live, but he was revisiting Metal Machine music.
And did you spend time with the both of them, with Laurie?
I've met Laurie a few times. We've been in touch and.
Did she read it?
She did read it,
and?
Yeah. She liked it a lot, I think.
Yeah.
She didn't know Lou in 76.
Sure.
And that's a whole side of Lou that, you know, I didn't know him either, and she didn't know, but I think she was able to enjoy it as a story.
The speculation. She enjoyed your fictional speculation of what that must have been like.
I think so, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And what did you read stuff about Lou at that time?
I have for years, but there's a lot of specific references that, you know, that you draw through. Like, for instance, you have him quoting, he quotes a little line from Paul Simon's song.
Yeah, from You Can Call Me Out.
50 Ways.
50 Ways, that's right, yeah.
But So why did I choose that? Well, Lou was in the movie One Trick Pony,
yeah,
which was Paul Simon's Lou
I remember that,
Lou,
yeah.
Right. So trying to, you know, if you use a reference. Or
you so he knew, you know, he knew, you know, he knew that record.
He knew Paul Simon. He
sure.
knew the record. And yeah. I was like, okay, so
with the New York boys.
Right.
Yeah.
So trying to take little details and weave them into the narrative.
Well, the thing that always was amazing about Lou to me is from when I read Please Kill Me, you know, and they start with, they have, you know, bits and pieces of Lou in that book, The Oral History of Punk.
Well, they put him on the cover of the first punk magazine, The Legs. And,
I just saw them the other night.
Yeah.
They were in town. They're doing another book, Legs and Jillian. But there was something about, like, his, you know, whatever they were doing at the factory, you know, Lou saw, you know, no difference. But in some respects, in his mind, there was no, he didn't see any difference in terms of skill set or anything else from what he was doing to what Jimi Hendrix was doing, like, for or anybody else. Like, you know, he thought he was just as good a guitar player as anybody else, right?
Very underrated guitar player, I think.
I think he's an underrated guitar player, but I also, it struck me that, like, in terms of rock and roll, it's not about how well you do anything. It's about how you get your ideas across.
Is it a good, can you write a good song?
Yeah.
Does it sound good? I mean, virtuosity has its place, of course, especially in, yeah. you know, other forms of music, but it has its place in rock, but is it a good song? Can yeah. you write a good song?
Well, there's also that great moment in the book where you talk about, you weren't even tripping, you weren't even on drugs, but that day where you were with her, with Veronica, and you all
you
of
mean
a sudden,
the character in the book?
Yeah, yeah, the character in the book, Matt, where, I do that all the time, where that character starts to realize how his brain works.
Right.
Like, he's all wide open and he's taking in the day, and like you can feel him forming his brain.
It's, yeah, I mean, it's endorphins coming from
her
being in love.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And that all-encompassing feeling of when you fall for someone, and it's, you know, I think it does alter your brain chemistry. I mean, there's hormones that start
sure.
to really go into your
yeah.
into your bloodstream, and it allows for a different... I mean, that happened when I met my wife.
Yeah.
It was like 3 days where it was like I was on a drug.
Oh, yeah?
I mean, literally, my brain was going in ways I'd never, never experienced ever. And it was going on and on and on and on.
Oh, yeah? Yeah? And did yeah. that 3 days that lasted?
Well, I mean, that's the, I don't think you can stay like that. You think you'll die because I didn't sleep.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah, I was
right,
awake.
Right, sure, sure.
You know? I mean, yeah. that's a sign that there's something special happening here.
Yeah. And I like how you brought in the end in the institution that, you know, Ginsberg was supposedly there. Like, you know, like the sort of the legacy of institutionalized geniuses.
Right.
You know,
and they're allowed to reveal the fact that if they had died,
yeah.
then they could say, yes, yeah, they were here. But if they're alive, it's
they
kind
couldn't.
Of private.
Who were the other two? Lenny Bruce and
Judy Garland.
And Judy Garland. Well, look, man, you know, it's good to see you. And the book is great. And, you know, and also, like, I want to make sure people know that, like, this isn't a book about Lou Reed. Lou Reed is, you know, fairly, he's an important character in it. But, you know, when you look at the breadth of the book, it's not like you're doing a book about Lou Reed.
No,
you know?
No, it's a coming of age story.
Oh, no, absolutely. He's just a guy in the, you know, in the building.
Right.
But, you know, more importantly, you know, even the relationship with Veronica, you know, and then
right.
the relationship with the kid in his own mind, you know.
Right.
But
that's probably the most important relationship
yeah.
is him to his own mind and trying to figure out what it means to be a human being and be, you know, an adult.
And I thought it ended well. It's hard to end a book.
It's hard to end a book. You're right. And it has to be organic and it has to kind of make sense.
But you did a great job. It's your first novel, right?
First novel. Yeah.
Good, man. I think it's a great great coming-of-age story, and I think it's a great homage to Lou as well.
That's what I tried to do, well,
yeah.
both of those things.
Good. Well, thanks for coming by, man.
Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure.
I love that guy, and I love the book. I honestly do. It's called The Perfume Burned His Eyes. It's out now. Get it wherever you get books, and that was nice to talk to Michael. Oh, my God. It's so bizarre being here. It will get less bizarre. I promise. It will get less bizarre. So Neil Patrick Harris wanted to do the show. He's a fan of the show, and we tried to get him a while back, and we couldn't, and it was a lovely chat. He's on the new show Genius Junior, Sunday nights on NBC. He's also on the Netflix show A Series of Unfortunate Events, All episodes of season two are now available. And this is me talking to Neil Patrick Harris. Look at, you know what you're doing.
Look at that. I pointed the microphone at my mouth.
You did. I can't tell you how few people understand that mic. When I tell them you can just move it in, they're just like baffled that the mic is on this thing for a reason. That you can, you know, you have freedom.
I find that strange with actor people in general.
But yeah, especially if they do voiceovers, they should know.
Right.
But I guess when you go into those booths,
ADR, they don't do looping.
I know, but you know what? It's already set up for you, and there's three guys in there, right? So the mic's like stationary, and they tell you where to stand. You know, this is a radio thing.
I wonder that with the award shows.
What about it?
With the actors, they come in to, then their job is to walk up to the thing and read the giant teleprompter.
Yeah.
And then they still look so
baffled
by the process.
You know what, it's a unique skill. Not everybody can do teleprompter. It's just, I don't know why.
Why? I mean,
I don't know why.
You've gotten familiar with the text, assuming.
Maybe not.
Yeah, maybe you're just.
Maybe you're like, well, I'm sure you read it. Yeah. But I don't know. Some people just, they look like they're reading. Other people look like they're just talking.
I think that they're just, I think that they're freaked out by the big room with all the people staring at them.
I don't know how you
guys do it. I feel like actors are much more comfortable in closed off.
Film actors.
Yeah.
And TV actors.
Yeah, more film actors, I guess, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, they don't do the
closed
big rooms.
Sets.
Yeah, yeah. And they, you know, they're protected. They're insulated. They can just be in their own little world and then surrounded by just a small group of people.
And fail, but no one knows.
And cameras. Yeah, no one knows.
That's true. With the award show, you get one shot at it, and if you fail, then everyone sees that.
What, is that why you're out here? Because you thought you were hosting?
Am I not hosting this show? Oh, I'm sorry.
The Oscars.
I thought that's why I was in the orange chair.
No, not this show.
The Oscars. No, I wasn't. I was in town. We watched the Oscars in New York.
Oh, really?
What a beast that show is. It's a beast.
But you somehow have, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, you're, well, maybe we should start earlier. You're one of the great song and dance men out of New Mexico.
Out of New Mexico, yes. And I've never taken a dance lesson ever. I've never studied dance, but apparently I'm a song and dance man.
Don't you think you are somewhat?
No, I'm very insecure when it comes to dancing, and I have to do a fair amount of it live.
Right.
And big one-offs.
Yeah.
Which is probably the worst way to do it, because you don't have the opportunity to do it again, to screw up the thing, and you're surrounded by professional dancers
who are fantastic.
Yeah, not really,
good.
Because you're the one in the front.
Right, but you're the one that just knows a few moves, and they're like spinning around.
Well, that's what happens.
Yeah, of course. So
they learn my skill set.
Yeah, and they make you look good.
I just sway left and right with my hands out.
Like, classic song and dance man.
That's the move. Yeah.
So New Mexico, like, I don't meet many people that grew up there. And I wasn't even born there, and you were born there.
Yeah.
In Albuquerque.
What do you know of New Mexico?
What do you mean? I was there from third grade till I graduated high school. My dad's still there.
Seriously?
Yeah.
I didn't know there was a New Mexico connection.
Oh, hell yeah, man. I grew up, I went to Highland High.
No way.
Graduated from Highland High.
Nice. My father graduated from Highland High, I think.
Is that true?
I think so. I think it's a great place to have been raised.
I was
born in Albuquerque.
Yeah.
My mother was from Portales, New Mexico. My dad was from Albuquerque.
Portales?
Yep. Yeah, and they met in college. Quintessential UNM college, sweethearts.
Uh-huh.
Fraternity, sorority, the whole nine. He gave her his ring.
Oh, really?
Well, they used pledged.
To do, yeah, something like that. Yeah. That was old timey.
It was very old timey. And they are still together to this day.
Really?
Still in love, still happily, adorably old.
And you grew up in, are they in New Mexico?
In New Mexico still. They're in Albuquerque. They moved to Roswell. So we lived in Roswell for a couple of years.
So what, were you in the sort of space alien business?
I was filled with all kinds of fluids, and I don't remember much of it.
They're experimenting.
Lots of nightmares. No, I barely remember that. And then we moved to Ruidoso, New Mexico.
Ruidoso.
Yep. Have you been there? Ski resort town in the winter.
So, and there's a
horse
track.
Racing in the summer.
Ruidoso Downs.
Ruidoso Downs. All-American futurity. Quarter horse racing.
Yeah, my dad wanted me to buy some property. He had a friend down there. My dad's got a lot of big ideas.
Nice.
And he knows a guy who's got some land down there. He wanted me to open a playhouse.
Oh,
he thought like
that would have been awesome.
Like Imus, like I could do the radio show from the playhouse and then
do summer stock.
Yeah, do summer stock in Ruidoso.
That'll get you places.
I don't even know what's in Ruidoso. I mean, I grew up my entire life in New Mexico. I don't even know if I've driven through it.
It's west. It's southwest
of Albuquerque.
3 hours of Albuquerque.
Well, you know, like Truth or Consequences has become sort of a thing.
Yeah.
Like people were buying houses there, I heard.
Recently?
Yeah.
I used to go to Truth or Consequences when my father's father, when he was still alive, he would fly. He had a private little plane, little tiny plane.
Oh, he owned a plane?
Yep. And not fancy like, but
no, but just one of those
and
planes.
We would fly when I was a little kid to
like a mid-sized car plane.
Yeah, and we'd go fishing.
He would fly?
Yeah.
And you just get in the plane?
And my grandma was in the passenger seat, which she was co-piloting.
And you were in back?
Yeah.
In a plane?
Yeah. And we went and they had a motor home that was, and he taught me how to shoot a gun.
Sure.
And
you
got
to learn that. Yeah, I went to camp up in Pecos. We shot guns. We loaded shotgun shells.
Incredibly appreciative of my New Mexico upbringing.
So you know how to shoot? You know how to fish? Did that come in handy?
Yeah, in Harlem, where I live now. Does it ever?
Do you ever go fishing, Neil?
No, you know what? I do have a desire, though, to camp and fish and all that sort of Boy Scout stuff. I love that stuff, yeah.
Why don't you?
I ponder that because I'm filming a Netflix show right now in Vancouver.
Which one?
It's called A Series of Unfortunate Events based on the Lemony Snicket books.
Yeah, that guy. I know that guy. The guy who wrote the books. I met him once.
Daniel Handler.
Yeah, he's an interesting guy.
Very interesting guy. Hilarious. Yeah.
Hit the jackpot with those fucking books, huh?
Yeah, there were 13 of them.
Yeah.
And we're making them into a series. So
dark children's tales.
Indeed. Barry Sonnenfeld's the executive producer.
The Baudelaire family.
The Baudelaires. Klaus. Yeah. Yeah. Violet and Sunny.
You know, it's like not going to, like, you know, just the idea of naming a children's character the Baudelaires and all that baggage that name brings is kind of beautiful.
It's amazing. And I play Count Olaf, the evil villain.
So you're like in all of them.
Oh, yeah. And I have 3 hours of prosthetic makeup every morning. And
oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's a big fun deal. But while I'm there.
Yeah,
That sounded like a plug.
Camping.
It sounded like I was fishing for a plug.
No.
But there's so much hiking and camping and Whistler and BC is extraordinary. Oof, and awesome. I keep wanting to go camping.
Yeah.
But it hasn't happened yet. This is year three that I've been there.
I think at your level, you could probably just call somebody to set up everything you need.
But that's what you don't want to do, right?
I don't know. Are you going to buy a tent?
Because I grew up in tiny town New Mexico where the great thing about living there is that it was one school and one town and you...
In Ruidoso.
Yeah, and you knew how to... I lived there my whole childhood up until
I was 13. And your grandparents had mobile home, but mobile home's different.
That was in Truth or Consequences.
Oh.
We had a nice house that my father actually built.
With his own two hands?
Yeah.
Wow.
Was he a house builder? No, he's an attorney.
Hmm.
But we knew how to then get from my house to a friend's house by going through the woods.
Yeah.
And you knew, Hunger Games style, that this tree, you turn this way, and you could run full sprint and all of that. So we would camp and fish and do all of those things.
Intense?
Yeah, for totally. I thought you meant, was it intense? It was very intense.
Intense.
Yeah, but tents are great. And now that I have kids, and they're 7, first grade, it seems like the appropriate time to be taking them out,
man.
And doing that.
Get them out there. Scare them with the camping.
Because I don't like the camping in California. I've been camping where you just go to a campsite.
KOA.
And there's just 15 different...
Campgrounds of America.
...spots where people have built fires, and it's already a fire ring.
And there's a public restroom with showers.
Yeah.
That kind of place you're talking about. It's not quite camping, but it's not horrible.
It feels like you're tailgating.
Well, the thing is with kids, you know, like at a certain age, like if it's a nice campground and they do have facilities, it's, you know, it's a load off. You know, you want
to. But that's the whole point. You want to go, you want to hike out to a place where you're theoretically alone.
Okay.
And well, so if you're going to poop somewhere, you have to find the poop place, declare it, dig a hole, do the whole thing, right?
Yeah.
If you go to the can and it's this weird little
building. I don't know. Like, I think I'm out, you know, and wait, once. looking for the poop hole. I'm okay with it, but I think as a family, if the four of you go and you got two kids, it's going to be quite an ordeal. The pooping. That's what I'm thinking. It's fine, but you
just
know,
bring those little wet nap things.
And then, and then what are you going to do with those?
Oh, that's a good question. You'd need a poop hole for the things.
You're going to need a bag. You're going to need a bag. No. Yeah. Okay, see, now you're carrying.
Is it getting worse?
Yeah, there's extra baggage there. I don't know.
Literally. Like,
I think there's probably a good way. There's a middle ground.
A campground.
I remember, yes. I bought a tent And it was with my second wife, and we were going to go camping. I think we did it once. And we ended up at a campground. It wasn't great, but it wasn't horrible. It wasn't comfortable.
Were there other people in other campsites right around you? Because I feel like that would be is what I wouldn't like.
Well, yeah, that'd be bad, because then people would recognize you, and then you'd have to deal with that shit.
No, I don't think about that. I just think I'd look at their tent and our, tent and think, is our tent, should I have put it better?
Yeah, you got to put the tent up either way.
Yeah.
And with four people, you got to get a pretty big tent.
Yeah, scrambled eggs.
Yeah, sure.
Enough, or should I have brought the fucking bacon like those guys did?
Right.
I'd rather just be by myself.
The cooler.
Being cool.
That's right, the food,
just
man.
Just cool enough.
Then you got to buy the camping cooking stuff.
It's a lot of stuff, but it's worth it, and I want to do it, and I'm vowing to you here and now. We're there until May.
The whole family's there?
No, I'm there. They're going to come for a spell.
Okay. So why are you down here? Did we cover that?
Why am I down here in LA?
Yeah.
I'm promoting multiple things. Dude, I have a bunch of random things that are happening. I'm promoting right now an NBC quiz show called Genius Junior that I'm doing.
This is kids?
Producing and hosting.
The classic classic take on the old Smart Kid show.
And on sort of the college Smart Bowl. No, it's kids. It's 8 to 14. But that's kind of the idea. Teams of three kids.
Yeah.
And I'm the host, and I do series
kids,
of
like the
questions.
Really smart kids.
Correct.
So the kids that, you know, they're impressive, but you kind of feel bad for them.
That was my worry, right? They did a national search to get all these kids, and they wound up with actual people kids.
Yeah.
That actually are nice and have other hobbies. Yeah. There's a round where it's a spelling round, and they have to spell as many words as they can in 90 seconds or 60 seconds, and they have to spell them backwards.
Okay.
So I'll say spell omnidirectional backwards. And as fast as you could spell it forwards, they spell it backwards.
Seriously?
And it is unbelievably exciting to watch. It's jaw-dropping.
And the kids are having a good time?
Super having a good time. They were super supportive of each other. That was my only concern as a human, is that we bring these kids to a sound stage and lights and an audience, and then their takeaway at the end is that it was not fun or bad.
Oh, right.
I wanted to make sure that this unique weirdness was something that they enjoyed.
The only thing I really like, the only thing that comes to mind for me right now with that show, or the idea of that show, is that show in the movie Magnolia. You remember? The washed up TV actor father who brings his kid, he's a genius, and they don't let him pee.
Yeah. No, we let them pee. We gave them pee breaks.
Good. That's all. I think that was a long way around me asking you.
Could the kids pee?
Do you torture the kids?
No, I was so aware, dude. I was a little kid actor. I mean, I wasn't that little when I started.
How did you survive that?
Well, I have really nice parents, and I grew up in New Mexico, so I didn't come from a line of parents who were in the business or who needed me to accomplish certain things.
Well,
was this random circumstance that allowed me to start working.
Let's talk about that. So you're in Ruidoso?
Yeah.
Did you go, you went all the way through high school in Ruidoso?
I went through, I think in the beginning of my freshman year of high school, we moved back to Albuquerque.
What part of town?
My brother had graduated, and then we moved to Albuquerque.
Just two of you?
Yep, older brother.
What part of town?
In Albuquerque?
Yeah.
The Northeast Heights.
Now, how do you become Doogie Howser?
So I'm in, at that point, I'm still in elementary school.
Oh, really? When you
move
back?
Thing. No, I'm still in Ruidoso.
Yeah.
And there's a summer from eighth, I just graduated the eighth grade.
Yeah.
And there was a high school program at New Mexico State in Las Cruces for theater students, a theater camp.
Now, were you doing theater? You weren't doing theater.
I was a sort of precocious little kid in Ruidoso. So I was in the Episcopal Church adult choir at 10.
Uh-huh.
And I was the leader of the choir in the middle school. I'd teach harmony parts. I was a bit of, you know.
That guy.
That kid. I liked to perform.
It's good you had good parents.
Pep rallies and stuff.
It was good you
Yeah, right?
It's good you had good parents and you have people at least got your back, huh?
So the choir director and the band director thought that I should go to a performing arts high school.
Uh-huh.
Which we thought was just a shitty idea.
Who? You and your family?
Yeah. And you're
what, being, to go to New York? You'd have to go to New York.
I don't know. California, New York. You're just entirely uprooted. Felt like military school, just sending your child away for a whole other thing.
Yeah, with not as much discipline as military school, I'm thinking.
You think?
I think.
Probably so. And so I ended up going to this I was one of the youngest kids in this drama camp at Mexico State. So I got to stay in the dorms. It was helmed by Mark Medoff, prolific playwright.
Right.
Wrote Children of a Lesser God.
Oh, right.
Which is being revived on Broadway this coming season. And he had written this movie called Clara's Heart, a Whoopi Goldberg movie that they were doing for Warner Brothers. Hmm. And the opposite lead was a waspy kid in Baltimore.
Yeah.
And he was the parents were getting divorced and she was their Jamaican maid. And she sort of, it was based on a book. So she helped him through his the ups and downs of that. And I happened to be at this camp and I happened to be in Mark's cold reading audition class.
Yeah.
And I happened to leave an impression upon him, and he thought, and he didn't say anything to me. He told my parents at the end of the camp, hey, would your son be interested in auditioning for this film?
Yeah.
They thought he was joking, because it turns out Star Search had come through Alamogordo and had convinced us all that if we would go and give, well, I don't know, $350.
Alamogordo, that's what they scouted in Alamogordo.
Go to Alamogordo and do Star Search regionals. And if we won that, we'd go do Star Search state. And if we got that, we'd go on the show. So we went and did that.
Is that how that worked? Star Search?
Apparently not, because it was a complete sham. It was not Star Search at all. It was some jackass dude that just took everyone's money and left. So we did the show in some weird place in Alamogordo and then left.
Introduction to show business.
It was.
Yeah.
And so then this guy, Mark Medoff, comes to my parents at the end of this camp and says, hey, I got this movie.
We're not falling for that twice.
I want your kid. That's what they said. They said, no, we're not interested. Yeah, send us a script, buddy. And so sure enough, they sent a script, a FedEx script from Warner Brothers.
That's so funny.
To Ruidoso.
Your folks are already cynical.
And then it was real. So then they had to sit me down and explain that that had all happened. And it was all very real. I ended up getting that movie. I was 12, turning 13. Filmed that movie. And then
flew out to L.A.
Flew to Baltimore, Maryland.
Baltimore.
St. Michael's, Maryland.
Was it a big part?
That was
part.
The lead.
Oh,
it was
wow.
The co-lead opposite Whoopi. So it was a big.
Was she nice to
education.
You?
She's awesome.
Oh, good.
Has she ever been on the show?
No, I'd like to get hold of her. I have to go to New York. I think she's hanging out in New York.
Yeah, she doesn't like to fly.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Are you guys still friends?
She takes buses. Yeah. She's very mentory. When I first met her, I got to fly to Malibu to actually meet with her, which was another surreal experience.
She lived out there then?
Yeah. So in the middle of nowhere. New Mexico, going to Malibu on the coast, pulling up to a house, walking into this house, which is great.
Yeah.
And then down the stairs was fucking Whoopi Goldberg
just
getting long dreads put in.
Oh, really? Outdoors?
Yeah. Like,
was it outdoors?
No, it was inside.
Oh, okay.
And I got to sit
and
chew the fat with her for a little bit, and she was super nice. What I'm very appreciative of is that she talked to me like a person.
Uh-huh.
Like a coworker person as opposed to a child.
Uh-huh.
And my parents did the same, and I do the same to our kids. I think it's important to have kids be treated as if they're people.
Can you give me the option? Like, what does it sound like when you're not treating them like people?
Maybe more, well, it's probably how you're thinking, but more how you're speaking. So instead of saying, I would prefer if you said, hi, Tom, you're 11 years old. Welcome to the set. Here's where you're going to stand.
Yeah.
It's going to be a lot of pressure, but I believe that you're up for it, and it's going to be good. As opposed to, hi, so you're Tommy. I'm Neil. I'm going to be the host, so here's what's going to happen. There's going to be a lot of people, and it might make you nervous, but don't be nervous, okay? Can I see a smile right now? That's what I want, is a smile. I'm going to stay like that. Shit, I just find.
Well, it's horrible because they see you walk away and talk differently to everyone else.
Right.
You step away to one adult like, hey, this kid, you know.
Just be normal.
Yeah.
So I was very careful of the kids in the Genius Junior to make sure that their takeaway was positive.
So you had that experience throughout your career. People treated you, mostly people treated you like a grown-up or with a certain amount of, like, they didn't treat you like a little child?
Yeah, like you were a commodity that had something to help with as opposed to an annoying kid that they just had to deal with.
But you were an annoying kid.
Well,
you weren't.
I don't know. Hope I wasn't.
No, you seem very well grounded. It sounds like your parents were supportive and nice and decent people.
I've always loved the process of how things work.
Yeah.
I've never been super blinded by what comes from something. I'm more interested in how things work.
What does that mean? What do you mean?
Meaning, even coming here,
yeah.
I'm fascinated by the fact that it's literally just you here in your garage by yourself.
Did you think there were more?
I thought there'd be a couple more people that were managing the sound, and I thought that there would be I don't know.
Coffee, snacks.
Videographer guy that was filming it. I don't know what it was.
No, interesting.
But
no.
You're just, I like seeing while you're clicking on things on your computer.
Watching the levels.
I would wonder what program you're using.
I'm using GarageBand, old school.
I wanted to get into the GarageBand.
I don't do anything with it other than record voices. I go through an analog mixer for some reason. I do a backup on a Zoom, and then I watch the levels, and I can manage those with the little knobbies here. And then occasionally, I just, you know, I poke at your
easy.
I'm sorry. And eventually, I'll click or occasionally I'll click on your filmography.
Oh, nice.
To, you know,
for
kind
a little
of
research.
Yeah, well,
but
just
then
to
with
see
Garage,
where we're at.
GarageBand, do you go and put some cool beats underneath it?
Yeah, of course. It's going to be total hip hop. Oh, you know, that's my producer. I let him do whatever he wants. If he wants to do the Neil Patrick Harris dance mix, it's going to happen.
Nice. I'm into that.
Let me know when you feel like that's where it's needed.
Thumping bass.
Yeah. So you do these movies, and do you move out here?
So I did Clara's Heart, then I went back to my life, and then
in New Mexico.
Yep, and I was a child working at a Schlotzky sandwich shop.
Where, in Albuquerque?
In Ruidoso.
Oh, in Ruidoso, the only one.
The only one, I believe. It's still there. I was far too young.
I don't know how
they paid me.
Schlotzky's was exciting when it first came on.
Yeah, they're great.
It was a big round bread, the muffaletta sandwich, basically.
Sure.
Yeah, but I remember when it happened when we were probably, I was probably early on in high school, and it was exciting to have a new fast food place.
They're still delicious.
Wendy's, I remember when Wendy's happened too. It's before your time. But
I was super excited when a McDonald's opened up in Ruidoso. That was a big deal.
Really?
We were
remember it?
A Dairy Queen town.
Dairy Queen.
Yeah. We'd go get the ice cream cones that you
Brazier. What is the name of the burger? Brazen Burger. Brazier. Was it
Brazier? Yeah.
Brazier, right?
Something like that. What does that mean?
Yeah, I don't know, man.
Is that a guy's name?
No, I know. I think it's like, I don't know.
Braising? A thing you do with meat?
I don't know, but I remember it was sort of, I think that was the name of the burger. I don't remember eating it. Did they have Blake's Lotaburger?
Oh, yeah. Blake's Lotaburger.
No one knows about Blake's but us. Great. They were big. You get jalapenos on there, green chili.
Green
if you want.
Chili cheeseburgers, the best.
Green chili cheeseburgers.
So then I was just there, back in school, doing my thing, and then working at Schlotzky's.
Yeah.
I then had an agent from doing the movie.
Were you the singing Schlotzky's guy? I did enjoy
when I had the job to finish the sandwiches and call out the people's names.
Yeah.
And I would make up rhymes.
Uh-huh.
Okay. I would Lin-Manuel Miranda myself.
You couldn't help yourself, no matter where you were. I got some stage time.
Yeah.
I'm gonna talk to the people.
You want a 12-foot sandwich that's less than 2 feet. This sandwich is for a guy named Pete.
Oh, and some guy grumbles
up.
Saying,
Shut the fuck up, kid.
Look, kid, we're just trying to eat on break. So, all right, so you're okay.
And
so
then I went and I was asked randomly, occasionally, to go do other weird things. So I went and did a movie called Purple People Eater.
What was that?
On the Sheb Woolley song by the same name. Flying Purple People Eater. Sheb Woolley was in the show, in the movie.
He was?
Yep, as was.
Was that a big movie?
No, it was a children's film. It was one of my worst experiences. We got to film in L.A.
Why was it a worst experience?
It was just not good.
Really?
It was not well made, and the director
wasn't a
tyrant woman.
Oh, yeah?
And who was in that? What's her name?
Was it all kids? Was it one of those all kids thing?
It was a kids movie, except the co-star was... this giant puppet creature that was
the Purple People Eater.
Wouldn't you know, a one-eyed,
one-horned.
Ned Beatty.
Sure, Ned
was
Beatty.
My grandpa, and Shelley Winters was in it.
That's why that
was the pitch, and I said sure, because rather work than working at Schlotzky's.
Ned Beatty's great.
Go make a movie. Ned Beatty was great. And
was
he was lovely. Shelley Winters, a piece of work.
Yeah.
Oh. Mm. What are we waiting for? Oh, and she had a pillow. My back is always, my back is worried. And she had this round pillow to protect her butt. And so she'd carry around this pillow and that was
I feel like that's an Oscar winner you're talking about.
No, that's worth a VHS trip.
I feel like she was like a methody person. She was like one of the early... people's theater.
How method can you be in a movie called Purple People Eater?
Well, did you see her in Poseidon Adventure? She nailed it.
Nailed it.
Man, she did the swimming thing and then died right after.
Fewer puppets in that, probably. Then Doogie Howser came along, the audition for it. I ended up booking that job, and then we had moved to Albuquerque, I think, by then. So I do half the year in L.A. with a tutor, and then... since that was only a 30-minute single-camera show, When the season was done, it was right at second semester of school. I'd go back to Albuquerque.
And that was cool. And you were a celebrity.
I guess so, yeah.
I mean, Doogie Howser was a popular show.
It was.
And you did, like, how many did you make? Did that, like...
That was four seasons. I think they did 97 shows, enough for syndication.
Just barely,
yep.
Huh?
Yep.
So that was it. And then, like, you did that for, like, 3 or 4 years, and then you get done with that, and you're a grown-up, but you're Doogie Howser for a lot of people.
That's very true. And back then, it was a very divided work ethic. There were TV actors, and there were film actors, and they didn't intersect very often.
No, I know exactly. But, you know, in even like, even on TV, you know, you still had to deal with the sort of like, oh, it's Doogie Howser's in this one.
Sure, yeah.
But he's not Doogie Howser.
Sure.
Right?
That was quite the albatross.
For how long? You probably still get it occasionally.
Yeah, it's not like a sore subject or an open wound.
No, because you look youthful and you still look.
Yeah. I find people that say, hey, Doogie Howser, I love you on that other show.
Right.
Which is fine.
They don't know your real name. Yeah. You're just a point. It's Doogie Howser.
It wasn't.
And you did a bunch of other little parts, and you actually appeared as Doogie Howser in some other shows.
I did on a very special Roseanne episode.
You were a punchline of jokes forever.
I was punchlines of jokes here and there.
Yeah, because it was a funny idea.
Any
like,
medical
Doogie
young.
Howser.
Medical plus youth equals a Doogie Howser punchline.
Doogie Howser punchline. I go to the doctor.
There's
Doogie Howser.
Probably 75
yeah.
people who are doctors who look kind of youngish
yeah.
come up to me
yeah.
begrudgingly saying, I just have to tell you. And share their stories about how annoying it is that they're called Doogie Howser. And I feel their pain. But, you know, what I have learned in all of my 44 years is that I like to hope for longevity mm-hmm. and multiple chapters in a book and not just hoping that the thing that you're doing is what's going to happen forever.
Of course, of course.
And so I had that perspective at the beginning of Doogie Howser.
And you worked, you kept working.
Stephen Botchko was the producer of that show, and he had done Hill Street Blues and L.A. Law, and so
he did Doogie Howser.
Yeah, he was a one out, and David Kelly. So it was two. Really...
David Kelly. So is early on in both of their careers.
And
he just has a big thing now. What's his big thing now? The Little Lies. The
Big Little Lies. Oh yeah,
David
you're
Kelly?
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
Good for him.
And he did the other one with Calista Flockhart. What was that one?
Allie McBeal. This feels like a quiz show.
Married Michelle Pfeiffer, too.
He did, and she's still just gorgeous.
And great acting.
Yep.
She's a very good actress.
But Botchko said to me early on, listen, he sat me down and said, kid, listen, this is going to be like surfing, that you're going to catch this wave. We hope that it's good, that it lasts a long time. The wave will crash, and you will have to decide whether you want to swim back out. And in doing so, you're going to get nailed by other waves and have to right yourself. And once you do, you're going to sit out there for a while waiting for another good wave to come. And that was sort of his metaphor.
Uh-huh.
And I dug it, and I still appreciated it. So when I was stressed about the Doogie Howser-ness of it all, I appreciate at the same time that I just needed some time to pass between. And that was during the TV movie decade, where I could do a TV movie a year.
Yeah.
And where I...
Is that enough, though? Was it
They paid good money for
it. Oh, they did?
Yeah. And then you'd go to Vancouver or Toronto and you'd...
And were you living out here full-time by then?
I was living here full-time by then, yeah.
But you moved out after Doogie or
when
in the
I graduated
middle of Doogie?
In 91.
Towards the end of Doogie.
Yeah, I moved out here full time.
With your folks?
Nope.
No?
Solo style.
And were you out then?
No.
No?
No.
Not really. But you weren't struggling with anything.
Well, I think I was struggling more with figuring out who I was, to be as a person.
Right.
Sexuality certainly, I guess, a pivotal part of that, but just how to stand tall and how to move my limbs. Because when you're doing a show for 4 years, you're just meant to stand still so that the focus puller doesn't have to do much work.
Right.
You know?
And deliver the joke.
Yeah. So I found that I didn't know how to really move.
As an actor or as a human?
As a human. And then when I went out, people would sort of recognize me, and I kind of wanted anonymity, and I kind of wanted to just figure shit out and try to be an asshole or try to be goth or try to, I don't know, just what, try
Wait,
stuff.
Did you go through a goth thing?
No, I didn't. But I didn't have the ability to do that.
Of course not. People would have noticed. There'd just be pictures all over the place.
That was just
Doogie Howser goes goth.
I guess so. Well, thankfully, it wasn't a TMZ world. I mean, the internet was very, very new back then, too. So information still didn't pass so quickly. But I was just paranoid, and I didn't feel like I was able to just exist as I wanted to. I was still locked in this, how do I exist to please other people?
And I think the judgment was different. I mean, it still wasn't, you know, being out was not a huge, like, everyone wasn't out yet.
For sure. It was a question that was taboo to ask.
Yeah.
It was sort of a
shame
on you for asking the question.
And then everybody's sort of like, we think he's... Yeah.
And I was also really... I didn't develop very quickly.
Yeah.
So even at 17 or 18, I just looked much younger.
Right.
So opportunity never really came my way.
Yeah,
I had desires, but they were so... There was no way in LA I was going to, at 20 years old with a fake ID, go to Rage on Santa Monica Boulevard. You know, and just like see what happens. That was like not in...
That wasn't how you were going to get started?
No. So I just sort of did this sort of young Hollywood thing and went to all those bars that they went to.
Yeah. And did you date though?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
I dated a fair amount.
So
girls. I didn't date guys for a long time.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Is that what you mean by dating? Did I date guys?
Yeah.
No, how would I meet them?
I thought, well, I mean, you know, don't, like, how? I would have...
I mean, give me an instance where that would happen.
Well, you're hanging out with other young people, and I imagine that there's other young people that were in the same boat that you were, and you just had to sort of happen upon them.
Yeah, that never really...
Oh, never really happened?
I could assert that some of the friends that I hung out with were in a similar situation,
right?
But that wouldn't be a conversation.
Oh,
we'd
right.
We'd both be trying to act super tough,
right,
and straight.
Cool, right, yeah. Where are the chicks at?
Who you banging tonight, dude? Yeah. Smell my finger.
Oh, good. That one. That classic.
That was a great one.
Yeah, sure.
I use it a lot.
Did you?
No, I never did, actually.
But were you taking, like, what was your training, though? I mean, because you sort of came into the movement and the body and all that other stuff, but did you train as an actor at all?
No. No, I didn't. I did 4 years. I really just learned by being
one of those
on
guys.
Set.
Cause, right.
Because the Botchko Doogie Howser work, I mean, the name is ridiculous, but the work was good.
Yeah.
I mean, we were doing 6-7 pages a day of single camera, hardcore medical jargon.
Sure.
Walk and talks, long one shots. I mean, we were having to work hard. So I got a good education about how you make a film. Even though it was a TV show, it was single camera, and it was work. So when I was done with that, I went and started doing theater. I went and did some Shakespeare. I did Romeo and at the Old Globe in San Diego, and I did.
How'd that go for you?
Really, really great.
You could take you took to the language.
I took to the language. I was terrified of it. I felt like a super fish out of water.
No coach.
No, well, they gave me a guy named Dakin Matthews, who's still a prolific actor and works all the time, was living in San Diego, and he sat with me for a full week before we started the first rehearsal, and we went through all the text, and he explained iambic pentameter and what it meant, because one of the feelings I hate to this day is feeling fraudulent, you know, is feeling like I don't belong.
Yeah.
And so when you go to a Shakespeare company of people who have trained in the theater and Shakespeare, and now you're the lead.
Because you're a child star.
And because you're on TV.
Yeah.
You're at this weird, I thought a weird deficit of judgment.
Right.
And so, and there's no way to quickly inform yourself of the canon of Shakespeare.
Sure.
So I just kind of had to go for it and acknowledge that it was uncomfortable for me. And through that sweaty rehearsal feeling like shit, then you get better. And you kind of...
And how were the... how was the response?
Great! It was Dan Sullivan directed it. He's a big, giant, prolific film director, theater director. And Emily Bergel was my Juliet, and it was set in the past, so we were fighting with broadswords, and it was a really great production. And that's one of those things that once you wrap your head around Shakespeare and know why you're speaking, not just speaking the words to rhyme,
right?
Then 45 minutes will rip by... And you realize that you're lying there banging your head on the floor because you're wailing in a monologue.
Right.
And you're really actually in it.
Oh, wow.
I don't know. It sort of forced you
it's
to...
magic.
Yeah, because you're not speaking in contemporary dialogue. You're speaking within the world that you're in.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty intense world. I really, really enjoyed that. I went and did Rent, the musical.
After that?
The National,
so you got the bug?
National Tour of Rent. Yeah, I did theater for a while. And that's how I moved to New York to do more theater.
Well, was that because you wanted to, or because the TV work was what? Happening,
I always loved the spectacle of the theater.
Yeah?
Yeah. I would go to New York once I was doing TV and had the money to do it. I would go on hiatuses and see 14 shows in 11 days.
Really?
And just see everything that was there. I just fucking loved it. I love that. I still love it. I love that in the same theater you can sit and watch an amazing show with sets that move and performances.
You like the big stuff or all of it?
I tend to like the big stuff.
Mm-hmm.
My first big musical was Les Miserables that I saw. I have a backstory with Les Mis, but it's kind of boring. But,
what happened?
Well, I didn't get Clara's heart eventually.
Yeah.
Originally.
Yeah.
The
movie with Whoopi?
Yeah. They had a different director at that time. And
right.
They cast another kid. So I went and did the audition with Mark and all of that went really well. And then I didn't get it. And a kid named Braden Danner did it. And he was the original Gavroche.
Uh-huh.
Who's a character in Les Mis
on
Broadway.
Yeah.
So I suddenly felt kinship to this kid.
Because you saw him in Les Mis?
No, because I just knew that's who he was. Oh. So I bought the soundtrack to Les Mis.
Yeah.
And I listened to it and I just sort of felt like I had a brotherhood with him because I almost got this part and he got it. And so Les Mis became and still is probably my favorite of all the sort of musicals.
But I thought you did get the part eventually.
In
the movie.
Well, they ended up replacing the director and then replaced Braden and then hired a new director.
Did you ever meet Braden?
I've never met him, no. Doesn't feel the kinship and the brotherhood that I probably do towards him. I'd give him a bear hug and he'd punch me in the nuts.
I don't know. I don't know where that guy is. So then, like, after all this stuff, like, you get this other huge show and you're on there forever, but you do other stuff. Like this is how I'm conversing. I'm looking at all your stuff.
So I did a big chapter of theater and I did some Broadway stuff. And
which ones? Rent's not Broadway.
I did Proof.
Oh, that's big. Who'd you play opposite of?
Anne H.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Have you ever had her on the show?
No.
Ooh.
I haven't heard about her lately. I wonder if she's doing all right.
Shows like
here and there,
series
yeah.
work here and there. Yeah, she's on a new series. I did Cabaret as the MC.
Oh, that's great. But that was later, wasn't it? That was fairly recently. I mean, that was before your mother.
Correct. Sure. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
So I did that.
So you're becoming a real theater guy.
And then I was asked while I was doing Cabaret to be in that Harold and Kumar movie.
Okay.
Harold and Kumar.
And you played yourself? You played Doogie Howser?
Neil Patrick Harris. And I was this like super horny, drugged out.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Ecstasy guy. And I steal Harold and Kumar's car.
Yeah.
And I worked for a few days on that. And then
playing against type, I guess.
Very much against type. Uh-huh. But sort of owning the Doogie stuff and sort of being that joke.
Yeah.
But in a fun way.
Okay.
And I got a little bit of respect. Uh-huh. And then Carter Bays and Craig Thomas, who wrote How I Met Your Mother, and were the executives on that, were fans of that.
Okay.
And so I ended up auditioning and getting that.
And playing against type again.
Barney Stinson.
Yeah.
Nine years on that show.
That was definitely doubly syndicated.
Yeah. It's still on a lot of days, a lot of hours.
It's crazy. I talked to Radner years ago in here. I mean, you guys really had, and I've talked to Jason.
Sure.
But that was a huge show.
Yeah.
I think that erased some Doogie-ness,
mm-hmm.
right?
Totally, because he was nothing like Doogie in any way, and he was just super straight guy, baller, sharp dressed, scotch drinking.
Did you like doing that?
Loved. I loved that gig. That was a great, great gig.
Good people, right?
Great work environment, great people writing it, great woman directed it, and I got to wear suits all the time. I mean, he was a real character. But I think one of the fears that I had, and I assume other people have when they sign up for a sitcom, is that you wind up 6-7 years later being Urkel, you know, being sort of the butt of the
you
joke.
You beat that one.
The sight gag of
but
the joke.
But you beat that one.
I don't mean as a person. Yeah. I think Jaleel White's a super nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
I just mean you don't want to end up being the character on a sitcom where you walk in and everyone laughs at what you're wearing.
Gary Coleman.
You don't want to be the butt of the joke.
Yeah.
And you don't know if that's going to happen when you sign up to do the pilot because you don't even know if the pilot's going to get picked up.
Right.
In turn, Barney was the opposite of that.
He looked
great. Always had all these rules, delusionally awesome.
And also, but like you'd already sort of weathered that storm with Doogie Howser. Really?
I guess a little bit.
Sure. I mean, and then like it seems that everybody in that show, you know, weren't hampered at all by the TV prison of it.
No, I embraced it.
Yeah.
But I mean,
like you went on to do many other things, is sure. what I'm saying. Josh, he makes his own movies. He's around. Sure. He does stuff. But the other thing also I would imagine with something like that is that I don't know how people who make a shit ton of money really find it within themselves to keep working.
That's interesting.
No, I just mean like they're like, I wonder about that. I mean, it seems like that everyone does usually, you know, I'm not in that club. But it would seem that would buy you some reprieve or maybe you would think you would have won and maybe you do other things that you really wanted to do or maybe you're doing exactly what you want to do. I don't know.
I guess so. I mean, the notion, the sentence getting a shit ton of money makes it sound like it all comes at once. And I guess if you won the lottery or something,
right.
you'd be more inclined to drop everything
sure.
and then just change your life.
Yeah.
But when you're acting and you're aware of how much money you're not making
yeah.
and then you get a job and you're making good money
yeah.
but it's still season one and
right.
and you're hoping that it gets right. to syndication
yeah, yeah,
and then
yeah,
you
yeah.
renegotiate and you're suddenly spending more because you're making more
sure,
and it
yeah.
suddenly doesn't feel like you've got the windfall.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
when it's done, then I was thinking more of what do I do now to sort of maintain
yeah, the four houses?
The ability to work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What do I do now to maintain this building I bought?
I didn't have a building.
Okay.
I wasn't a big building and cars guy. I had a nice house in the valley.
Yeah, I don't like to buy anything. I bought this other house and I'm freaking out about it. Like I'm surprised I did it, but
was
I'm
it
excited
expensive?
About it. Yeah.
Was it more expensive than you wanted to pay for it?
Not really, because like I'm in that situation where I don't have kids, I don't have a mm. wife, and like I made some money with the shows, and this does well, and you know I'm on Glow on Netflix now, and
you're so good on that show.
Oh, thanks, buddy.
Can I just say?
Oh, thank you.
It's so good, and you're so horrible on it in such a subtle way. Like your character is horrible, not
yeah,
you as an actor
yeah,
person.
Yeah. yeah, good. Well, I appreciate.
I've
that.
Never done cocaine in my life ever.
Yeah,
and so it seems very. Cokey.
So no drugs for you ever?
No, I've smoked a fair amount of pot and
yeah.
And
that's fun, right?
I played with the acid-y.
Yeah,
I did that once. I did the mushrooms a few times.
Sure.
Every time, convinced this time would be better than the last, and I always wind up in my bathroom in front of the mirror looking at myself going, you can do this, dude. Pull your shit together. You can just fucking just go. Just let go. Just pull your fucking shit together. And then it never works out.
A night of that.
Always. Five times I've done that, and I decided I'm done with that.
Done with mushrooms.
But the cocaine never, ever has ever come my way. I have never been at
amazing.
A party where there was I don't know, a pile of it on a table.
Yeah,
I've never been.
That's pretty high end party, specific type of party.
I went to a party at Jack Nicholson's house.
Yeah,
and I was talking to everyone, was super amped up, and they were all so lovely. And it turns, and they kept going upstairs to the bathrooms upstairs.
Yeah, sure.
And I only realized as I was getting in the car that's probably what was going on.
Yeah.
But it's never been offered me. I don't know why.
Why were you at Jack Nicholson's house?
That's a really good question. Friend of a friend.
Oh yeah.
I guess so.
Did
yeah.
you talk to Jack?
I did say hello to him, yeah.
And that was about it?
That was about it, yeah.
No.
His daughter?
Uh-huh.
Does he have a daughter?
I think so, yeah.
I think she was in her 20s or something like that, so it was more her party than...
And was he wandering around like a bathrobe? Like
he had sunglasses on,
uh-huh.
but I don't think a bathrobe.
I wonder how he's doing out there. I just wonder about him. Like, I miss seeing him at the Oscars and stuff, but he's old now, you know?
Does he not act anymore, really, ever?
I haven't seen him at all in anything, but he used to, at the very least, sit up front at the Oscars.
Yeah. And give the look.
Yeah, with his glasses
and
on.
And he knew he was stoned and he'd
yeah.
all... Yeah, yeah. I love that stuff.
Where is he? He wasn't there when you hosted, was he?
I don't believe so, no.
Like, I don't remember when he stopped going. So...
It was Oprah was in the front row when I was there. That was the big deal. Oprah.
But what is
Meryl.
It with the... Now, are you a practicing magician?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
I'm a collector and I love magic. I love... The same way I love circus and juggling and... Sort of the variety arts.
How are you juggling?
Trampolining. Pretty good.
You do all those things? You
do
trapeze?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
And you trampoline?
Yeah.
And you do magic? Close up magic? Or do you do big.
I've been
at your house. You have a tank?
I've been a water torture cell. Yeah. That's where the kids go when yeah. they misbehave.
Because I see all through your sort of information about you, there's a through line of magic.
I love live experiential entertainment.
Uh-huh.
And maybe that came from being in Ruidoso, and once a year the state fair would be in Albuquerque. We'd drive up for 3 hours, and at the state fair there would be the midway, and you'd go back and there'd be the freak show, you know. And
Ronnie and Donnie.
You'd go and you'd see Popeye, the dude with his eyes that would open up.
And
his eyes would bulge and stick out. And
Did you see the guy with the biggest feet?
No.
Did you see Ronnie and Donnie, the Siamese twins? They were touring for a while.
Really? No, I never saw them. It was mostly livestock. It would be the world's biggest pig.
Oh, but you didn't see the little guy, the world's littlest man, who was all like, he looked like a little basketball? I think there
might have been a little person, maybe. But probably not that guy. Not that dude.
Did you get the Indian fried bread?
Always.
Yeah.
But through that was a lot of magic tricks, right? Because there'd also be the spider lady, which was just a magic trick. It was a woman that was in a,
sure.
it looked like she was on a cobweb, and her arms were spider arms, but it was just a mirror, a 45-degree mirror effect, right? And so I was kind of fascinated by magic through performance. And so I loved all of that. So I loved when circuses would come into town. I saw every Cirque du Soleil show when it would go through Santa Monica. And my love of magic just kind of grew. I became a junior member of the Magic Castle.
Yeah.
And then...
How do you become that? Do you have to perform for people?
Yeah, I auditioned. Did a little set.
You know Andrew Goldenhirsch?
I do very well. Yeah. Lovely guy.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
Super good.
He's a good magician, right?
Great magician.
Yeah.
And he's a great magician. He'll do all kinds of gigs. He can do... fill a whole stage at the Magic Castle, but he can also go and work a business party or something.
Yeah, work a line.
Do equally good stuff. And so we live in a technological society almost exclusively now.
Yeah.
A lot of people wait to see movies on Apple TV because their screen in their living room is gigantic.
Right.
So why not just wait and own it, right? So I think there's reason to go see Broadway shows. There's reason to go to Sleep No More and see immersive theater. There's a reason to go to the Magic Castle. Magic is one of those things that is much, much better when you're doing it live.
The human element.
You're blown away when you see David Copperfield saw someone in two in front of you. Less exciting as a TV special.
Yeah.
Still cool to see.
Right.
But you assume there's trickery. But when you're actually there watching this stuff actually happen. So.
Yeah, I'm pretty fascinated with it.
Do you see the
Cirque
du Soleil shows?
Nope. I don't go to anything.
Why?
I don't know, man.
Don't you feel like...
I'm missing life? A little.
That kind of life. Well, like, but you go... You
I
check
always
out
get
other...
very moved. You know what I mean? Like, I watch a lot of comedy. I'll go see some music. I'll go see shows sometimes. Like
cabarets and...
Well, not too much of that. I don't do the cabaret thing. But like, when I go to New York, the last few times I've been there, I've been set up with tickets because I interviewed Annie Baker, so I saw her stuff.
Nice.
I like musicals when I go. But I don't seek them out. I don't know why. There's some part of me that just doesn't want to have a good time, Neil.
Okay.
I don't know why.
You don't?
I always enjoy them.
So how are you with exercise?
Good.
Do you consider that a bad time?
Like
it's
a bad time.
You know it's going to be a bad time, but you're going to do it anyway?
It's pretty bad. I could use more cardio. How are you with it?
Yeah, I work out a fair amount.
Yeah.
But it's hard for me to say go on a hike.
Yeah.
Once I'm on the hike, I'm loving it.
It's nice, yeah.
But the idea...
Yeah, I feel that way about everything. That exact feeling is what
But there's not a part of you that says, I know that if I see a show like this... It's harder in L.A., though, because
to get
in a car and go to the Mark Taper Forum downtown and park and to see a show and you don't know anything
about it.
Oh, New
York, you just go. Like, are there house seats available? Can I get them?
Yeah, you get on the subway and you go see a
show. I always enjoy theater, even if it's shitty.
Well, the next time you're in New York, I'm producing a show, a one-man magic show by a guy named Derek Delgadio. It's called In and Of Itself.
Yeah.
And it's playing till August. And it's unbelievable.
It's all magic.
It's a monologue that he tells. It's about 80 minutes, no intermission. And throughout it, there's five different effects that he does. And none of them are pick a card, any card, or for my next trick kind of things.
Yeah.
It's all kind of ruminations about identity. And he speaks to the audience.
Yeah.
It's a truly special thing. It's extended four times and it's played almost for a year now. It's broken, broken records there.
I saw the magic show when I was a child.
With Doug Henning?
Yes.
No way.
I did.
I heard it wasn't very good.
I don't know. My grandma brought me in. I must have been like 8 or 9. When was that? Early 70s, right?
Mid
70s.
I think so.
So I was like 13, something maybe.
Doug Henning. He was great. Canadian magician from the...
Saw that when I was a kid. Saw the black Guys and Dolls when it first, the first
no kidding.
Black cast of Guys and Dolls, because my aunt and uncle brought me to that. I saw Beatlemania when I was a little kid.
I saw James Earl Jones in Fences here in LA, and that was a real pivotal moment because I was very emotional watching Lynn Thigpen recite a monologue while she peeled potatoes about how difficult her life was. It's a fantastic monologue.
It's great.
And I was weeping. And I was young. It was right at the beginning of coming to LA ever. Yeah. And I was really moved by the fact that I knew nothing about Baltimore or this plight or this life.
Yeah.
And I was so impacted by what it is they were saying.
Yeah.
And I think that theater has the opportunity to do that in a way that I probably wouldn't have been as moved if I was on my couch in the living room watching the same thing.
Yeah.
Because I would have distraction.
Sure.
And,
no, theater's great. I mean, like in my life, I've gone and I definitely like going.
Yeah, it's just a little bit hard, especially on the West Coast. It's you hard like, to do theater on the West Coast.
Well, who are your magicians? Give me a lesson. Historically, who should I know? Who are the greats?
Well, probably I would go stage magicians more. So Howard Thurston,
uh-huh.
Harry Houdini,
yeah.
Dante, Servais Leroy.
Yeah.
Those ones who invented and did the big giant tours
on
trains.
Yeah.
As far as mentalism, I think James Randi's super strong.
Mentalism, what's the difference? What's mentalism? Is that close up?
No, it's I can predict something that you're thinking of.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So,
and that's a trick.
Write something in this envelope.
They don't really do it.
I'll put this in an envelope.
Do you know the tricks?
Then I'll hold it up. I know most of the tricks, yeah.
Yeah. That doesn't bother you?
That I know the tricks?
Yeah.
No, because again, I like knowledge. So I like to know.
How do you know him? Did they tell you? Did somebody break the oath? Or are you part of the brotherhood so you're allowed to know him?
Well, I think when you've studied enough, you have you can suppose how things are done. You know,
oh, you do? Oh, there's
you know
moves.
Multiple methods sure, of how sure, things are accomplished. Sure. And I think what's fun is when someone like Derek and Derek Delgadio will come up with a whole different way to do anything. And
sure.
And then only a few people know how it's done at all.
Yeah.
And then magicians that see it are blown away because they have no idea.
Andrew takes, I think, a chicken or a rabbit out of his hair.
He does.
That seems difficult.
He takes a chicken out of his hair at the end.
Yeah, and then he does the thing with the butterfly tattoo.
Yeah.
Which he sold to Copperfield, but then I think he got it back.
Wasn't that an origami thing at first? Didn't he take an origami and fold it up into something and it turned into a butterfly?
Oh, maybe it was an origami. I thought that he actually made a butterfly tattoo turn into a butterfly. Maybe I'm misremembering it.
Close-up magic can go, I mean, you can go way back with people and names of people from who wrote amazing books to...
You like Ricky Jay? I mean, he's not really, what does he do? He's a historian, right?
I find Ricky Jay a curmudgeon.
Uh-huh.
And so it's from all accounts, I hear that he's, that unless he takes a shine to you, he doesn't like things. So uh-huh. that disappoints me a bit, but every show that I've seen him do, I've absolutely loved.
He's good?
Yeah, he's great. He is a historian.
Yeah.
In fact, his last show, I think there were a bunch of different numbers on a big giant screen behind him, and people would shout out a number, and the whatever was behind the number, something would appear, and he would talk for 20 minutes about whatever that was. So theoretically, on any show, you could see anything.
Yeah,
he knows a lot about the histories of magic that I certainly don't.
Yeah,
that's its own whole skill is knowing the.
I
names
think he
of
likes
people,
the dark side too,
where
the,
they're
the
from.
Sort of the hustle of it. You know, like
he
when,
was a hustler.
Yeah,
yeah.
Like when magicians were doing it for
I loved him as an actor, too.
He's good. He's in the Mammoth movies, usually. And he was in Magnolia. He was in Magnolia.
Boogie Nights, was he in that?
Have you ever talked to him, Paul Thomas Anderson?
No, I just read a whole article about him.
He's a very goofy guy.
Really?
He grew up in the Valley. His dad was a wacky, TV host from Cleveland or
That's
somewhere.
That's right.
And his dad and Tim Conway were best friends.
No way.
Yeah. Like I thought he was some like dark genius. He comes over here. He's just a goofy dude from the Valley. And it's very entertaining to talk to him.
So what is a goofy dude like that?
Where does he get that stuff? Why is he so fucking... Maybe that's just his, that's his public persona, but he's obviously an incredible filmmaker. And
the Phantom Thread?
He's got real balls with the filmmaking. He's not afraid of what's going to come at him.
Director. That's the job.
That's right.
That's where I'm headed.
Is it?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
That's the plan.
What are you going to
do? Right now, I'm quiz show host, producer. I'm actor on Netflix. I'm a children's book writer. And when all of this calms down, it's going to be directing more.
Well, let's talk about hosting real quick, though. Like, how did you sort of like get into that? Because that's like one of those jobs. Mm. There's a few people that do it. Not everybody does it. Some people get a shot at doing it, but you've done it a lot. So like you're a hoster. You can host a big event.
Mm-hmm.
The Oscars, the Tonys over and over again, the Emmys. You've mm-hmm. hosted all of them.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get into that? What was the...
I was on CBS, and
yeah.
So the Tonys was on CBS,
uh-huh.
and so they pull from their own talent pool because then they can
sure.
sort of self promote.
Yeah,
and so they asked me to host the Tonys 1 year, and it wasn't super heavy lifting. I think they had asked a bunch of other people who had passed.
Yeah,
and so they asked me to do it. It was the big opening number that they had done with not the host, but
yeah.
a bunch of all of the Broadway shows put together. It's one where Bret Michaels got whacked in the head from a set piece.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and,
yeah.
And that was a big controversy. And then I came out and told some jokes, and it went really well. And so then they were pleased with my confidence. And so I was still on the network when the Tonys came around the next year. So I did that. So once you've done it a couple times, you're on the short list of people. And then the Emmys... Every 4 years, it switches networks every year.
Uh-huh.
So every 4 years, it would go back to CBS.
Oh, okay.
So I did that.
Yeah.
Because of it was being on CBS.
And you could do it. Yeah, the chops.
I guess so, yeah.
And the Oscars, that must be the most intimidating gig in the world.
Yeah. Well.
Not really? I mean.
I just find it very, it's its own little machine that's eating its own tail. It's a hard one. It's a hard one to crack.
What, in what way? Like, I mean, you go out there, everyone in show business is there. It's
right.
intimidating in my mind. And, you know, I have to imagine that you have to sort of realize you're not going to get an amazing response.
Correct.
And you got to just suck it up.
It's the last award of a long cycle now of award shows.
Yeah.
So by the time they're at the Oscars, everyone is exhausted
uh-huh.
from the gauntlets of
yeah.
the Golden Globes, of,
right.
of all of them, SAG Awards. There's so many now, and Oscars is last. So you're dealing with actors who are promoting a show that they did a year and a half ago. They've already completed another show, and they're probably working on another movie.
For the movie, yeah.
So they're talking, they're glazy because they're talking about something
sure.
that's two chapters ago.
Yeah.
They're pretty sure who's going to win, because
yeah.
by that time, you kind of know that
right.
this actor's won 11 of the last
yeah,
12.
Right, yeah.
You still have to put on the thing and go around
yeah.
and do all the stuff. And you're waiting a long queue of cars, and then it's really intimidating and daunting, all the people screaming at you and the photographers. And
yeah.
you're sort of interacting with other famous people that you don't know, and that's a weird thing. And then you sit
yeah.
down, you can't eat, you can't drink. You're there for 4 hours. It's run by the Academy, the Motion Picture Academy,
yeah.
so you have to honor sound design, and you have to honor costume design, and
yeah.
you have to honor a lot of things that the general public doesn't know anything about.
Right.
So then it can read boring and
right.
inside baseball too much, because you need to let the sound designer thank all the people,
sure.
but no one knows who he's talking about. You
know, right.
The award show dynamic is tricky enough as it is.
Yeah.
And now I think the studios are releasing films to be Oscar contenders at a certain time to get into certain festivals. They're small films that then no one has really seen.
Right.
They don't make a lot of money. They just come out to be Oscar movies.
And, yeah, that's true. That's
and
true.
And then ratings drop, and then the everyone
right.
panics because yeah. how do we get more eyes on the show?
Yeah.
And you're talking about Whiplash, which was a great movie.
Yeah, but the only people that sees it is people who get screeners.
Exactly. Kind of. I get screeners and I
yeah.
don't end up seeing them all.
Yeah.
So I think it's just a difficult one.
It's a daunting beast.
It needs to be reshaped in some way, because there's so many award shows that are like it, but in many ways better.
I think Jimmy did great last year, and this year I think he did real well, but he was a little more biting last year. He took some more shots in the
agreed,
monologue.
Agreed, but this year there were so many controversial things that
I couldn't touch it.
That were hot buttons.
And
stuff,
they knew
right?
by, you know, after the Golden Globes, they can watch how the other hosts
sure.
handle things to see if anything's flying, and then be like, let's stay away from that.
But the Me Too movement, the Time Out movement,
yep.
very real
yep.
and valuable and valid
sure.
things, right? So
yep.
you can't really mock them.
Not
you
those,
can't really
yeah.
mock the people. You have to do a Harvey Weinstein joke, but if you go there too hard, you're,
yeah.
you know, it's a tricky
That's
line.
That's tricky.
But
I just like he busted balls on the actors more.
Yeah,
like
agreed.
He
busted balls. I thought that runner of the jet ski thing was brilliant.
Yeah, it was funny.
I thought it was so funny.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it was dumb, but it was something that that you at home could still, you know, make your own jokes about.
Well, that's what he does, is that he's able to bring it to the regular people. I love that he takes the piss out of the elevated nature,
sure,
of that thing. When he walked those people in last year from outside,
yeah, that was cool.
That was one of the best things ever. Just those people like with, ooh, their phones, you know, like...
He was good. He did a great, great job both years, I think.
Yeah,
I think
absolutely.
Jimmy Kimmel is an outstanding representation of award show host.
Yeah, it's good. And you're going to keep doing them, right?
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm,
I don't know. All right. So tell me.
You get asked to do them. You don't really.
You don't put in for it?
Right.
I'm available. So tell me about directing. When does that start? How much have you done?
I've done. I directed a How I Met Your Mother episode.
Yeah, just one out of 200.
Some theater stuff.
They wouldn't throw you another one?
Just the one. Yeah.
How hard did you have to fight for that one out of 200?
Well, it's more difficult being on the show.
Yeah, oh, that's
and then
true.
Directing multiples. You know, it's an ensemble cast.
It's not
cast,
a real great experience when you're on the show and directing, because you have to go back and forth.
You're double dipping a little bit. But I enjoyed it very much. Again, I really like being on set and watching the crew work and honoring what they do, and I think that part of it's fun. So it would be fun for me. I want to direct. I'm thinking of trying to reinvent kind of the improv comedy movie.
Like, give me an example of what that is.
The Guffman Christopher Guest ideal of filming stuff with bullet points and getting great actors that may not be. A-list, which is probably better due to scheduling, but that are super talented and funny.
You want to do one of those?
Yeah. I think that deserves to be done again, and I think not only would that be fun to watch, but if done right, it would be really fun to execute. It would be
really fun
to do. Have you done any of improv-y?
Yeah, I have. I did Joe Swanberg's Easy, which is on Netflix. I did two episodes of that, you know, each year. It's a show that is an anthology show, so it's just... 10 episodes that are their own thing, based in Chicago with Chicago people. And I played there was an episode first season with me as this guy, and then we brought the guy back, but it's all improv.
I love that. Or Curb Your Enthusiasm, I think, which was just great. But I kind of want to do something that would be fun to do and therefore be fun to watch.
Yeah, no, it sounds great. Would you be in it?
Probably not.
Okay. And you got people in mind? You got an idea in mind? Sounds like you got one.
I do. I have an idea in mind.
All right. When are you going to do it?
This fall would be my favorite choice, but we'll see if it can happen.
Shoot it for cheap.
That would be the idea. Some micro budget, shoot it for super cheap, and then own it outright, and then try and sell it and hope that it does well.
How did you like doing Hedwig?
Oh, I loved it.
Yeah, I talked to him.
John Cameron Mitchell?
Yeah. We did a pilot for something, an interview thing, but never got released. But I spent like 3 hours with him, and it's a really...
He's great. It was another chapter of my life that is so unlike me.
Yeah.
And yet I got to do it, and it was well received, and it was rock and roll, and I was just not a punk rock and roll guy, and I had my own internal issues about how to carry myself and not be too effeminate.
Uh-huh.
And so I had to get over that very quickly and own femininity and then stomp around in a very David Bowie kind of way and shriek all of these songs to an audience of Upper East Side people who'd paid too much money. And yet the show is very moving. So they're initially kind of taken aback. And then by the end of it, they were emotional and feeling empathy towards someone that was nothing like them. I don't know.
It was
fascinating to
be theater at its best.
A woman for a while.
Oh yeah. You loved it.
I don't know that I loved it. It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
Tucking your testicles up into your way up higher than they're supposed to be. And like,
oh yeah.
All of that stuff. Not so fun. Like getting into the stuff.
was tough.
Oh dude. Like eyelashes and making.
But it must've been like when you were done up, when it was finished and you looked at yourself, it really helps the transformation, right?
So much.
I mean, it's like so much of it. Like even when I put on Sam's clothes for Glow, I'm like, no, I'm this guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's,
and I'm now I'm doing Olaf.
In
Series of Unfortunate Events, and I look nothing like myself.
And you can just go to town. It's not really you.
Yeah, you're a little less insecure, self-conscious. Yeah,
oh, that's great. Well, it's great talking to you, man.
Thanks, buddy.
You feel good?
I feel great. This is I'm a huge fan of the podcast and have always been nervous about how it would go.
Really? I thought it went great.
It was fun. I didn't realize that you'd even started. Have you pressed play yet?
Oh, fuck. But how's it? Your kids are good. You're married.
Kids are
still
good. My husband's great.
Okay. Good.
We're working away. Kids are 7 years old. They're in the first grade. They couldn't be cooler. They're in that sweet pocket where they want to be your friend and they want to learn stuff and they're healthy.
Yeah.
And everything's super, super swell.
Good, man. I'm happy to hear it.
Thanks for having me on.
Yep. That was Neil Patrick Harris. As I said, Genius Jr., his new show is Sunday nights on NBC. He's also on Netflix, A Series of Unfortunate Events. All the episodes of season 2 are up now. And that's it. This is my first dispatch from the new space. If it sounds different, it might be a little different, but we're going to chip away. I'm going to make this the new home. It's going to happen. It's exciting. And I'm a little ungrounded, folks. I'm a little nervous, and a little. I feel kind of raw, a little vulnerable without my old garage. All right, go to wtfpod.com/tour to get venue and ticket information for my upcoming shows in London, Stockholm, Oslo, Amsterdam, and Dublin. And I haven't set up my amps yet. And I can't play guitar. I know that's heartbreaking, but I can do this. Boomer lives.